model, which we'd started talking about last time. So the idea is to bring in the world economy. After I finish this, I want to start talking about what's called the static neoclassical model. And then next time I want to begin working on the second page of Roman numeral 1. So on the second page, there's an article on the multiplier accelerator model. That's really what the first problem of the problem set is about. On Thursday, I want to talk about the Lucas model, which has a paper and a little bit of reading in the textbook. And then next week, on Tuesday, I want to spend one lecture on the Phillips curve. There's a handout on that. There's a little bit of reading in the textbook that introduces some ideas about differential equations. And then next Thursday, I want to finish up talking about the Dornbusch model, which is an elaboration on the Mundell-Fleming model. All right, so we have new behavioral functions. Last time, we used these stars for desired. We had desired net exports. And they were going to depend on the home real GDP, on the foreign GDP, and on the real interest rate. Let me just signify the signs of the partial derivatives by putting a sign here. Partial derivative with respect to the first argument was going to be negative, positive, positive. These were assumptions. Second, new behavioral functions. Behavioral function, I want CF star to be real, desired net foreign financial investment in the U.S. Started talking about this last time. Let me write it like that, with two arguments. Depends on the home nominal interest rate, depends on the sum of the foreign nominal interest rate, and it should depend on the sum of the foreign nominal interest rate and the anticipated rate of change in E, the nominal exchange rate. So dot means time derivative. E dot over E is like the percentage rate of change in E, the nominal exchange rate. We use the A for anticipated. All right. The assumptions I want to make here are that the sign here is negative, and here is positive. Let me talk for a minute, though, about this. So we're talking about financial investment. So you can take your dollar saving, put it in a savings bank in the U.S., or you could send it over to England. If you took your dollar and invested it, put it in the bank at home, after a brief amount of time, say delta, it would grow to $1 plus the interest rate, which is given in terms of percentage change per year. It's an annual rate times the amount of time that you've had. So maybe you've put it in the bank for one day, and you get 1/365th of the yearly interest. So you'd have this plus interest after this amount of time, delta. Another possibility is you could take your dollar and send it abroad. Now, remember the units on E are dollars per pound. The foreign currency is a pound. If I send it abroad, I've got my dollar, I'll get this many pounds for it. If there's $2 to a pound, E will be 2, and my dollar by half a pound. That'll be the number of pounds. Those pounds will grow with interest. Now, it's abroad, the money's abroad, so you get the foreign rate of interest. And then, when I bring them home, I get this many dollars.
Question? I thought this foreign investment, is it investment, net investment into the domestic economy? Or
it's out? Into the U.S.
So shouldn't partials be have opposite signs?
Ah, you're right. I got them backwards. So when the interest rate at home is high, it's attractive, so it comes in. Good. Thanks. So I took my dollar, it bought this many pounds, grew with interest to this many pounds, multiply it by this, I'll get dollars. The time is different by then. If I started at time t, it's now time t plus delta. I put a t on this one. All right, well, let's think about this for a minute. If E changes smoothly as a function of time, I could make a first-order approximation, a first-order Taylor series approximation of E t plus delta. It would be E at time t plus the derivative with respect to time times that. So it's like I've got a function of time and I'm approximating it like that with a first order Taylor series approximation. So this is a function of time through its subscript there. I made a first order approximation. The thing is smooth, and I'm talking about a small delta. This will be a good approximation, very good approximation. Well, then we could multiply this out. So it's, we've got 1 times E. We've got 1 times this thing, E dot, time derivative, times delta. We got this times delta times E, and we got this times this. Now, if delta is very small, when I square it, it's an order of magnitude smaller still, and I can afford to ignore it if I'm letting the delta get very small. Let's do that. Let's drop it. Now I've got 1 over E times each of these terms. 1 over E times E is just 1. This thing is E dot over E times delta. This thing is, again, the E's cancel. So it's just RF times delta. So when I want to compare investing at home to investing abroad, both terms have got this 1. The results have both got this 1 in them. Investing at home has R times delta. This one has RF plus E dot over E times delta. So the comparison that I want to make is between R and RF plus E dot over E. And those are the two arguments here. And as was pointed out, we're talking about net foreign financial investment in the U.S. When the interest rate in the U.S. is higher, that's going to be attractive. It's going to pull money in, financing in. When RF plus E dot over E is high, that'll take it out. Remember, the way I've defined this exchange rate, when this goes up, the dollar is devalued. If this is positive, it means I'm expecting the dollar to lose value. So if the interest rate in England is 4%, but I'm expecting the dollar to be devalued by 6%, I could have a 10% return if I invested my money over there. Because if the dollar is going to lose value, I want to be in pounds and bring it back, bring my funds back later after the dollar's lost value. All right. And in fact, in the Mundell-Fleming model, we make the assumption that foreign financial investments and American financial investments are perfect substitutes, so that all the funding goes where the interest return is highest. So the Mundell-Fleming model assumes that financial investments are perfect substitutes. So we have the extreme case that if the home interest rate is higher, including the anticipated currency changes, then there's a huge flow in. Both interest rates are the same, then people don't care where they invest their money. It's a matter of indifference. And if the home interest rate is lower, then all the money goes abroad. CF is an inflow, so it would be negative infinity. So this is like the purchasing power parity case now applied not to goods, but to financial investments. And that's the idea of the Mundell-Fleming model. Okay, questions about that? This analysis that I'm going through at this point is simpler than that. It's as if everybody has common expectations. If they're different, it'll be more complicated. If you think the return abroad is better, you'll be investing there. If I think the return at home is better, I'll be investing here. Then the model becomes more complicated, and we have to worry about how much heterogeneity there is and who's thinking what. But it's simpler than that. I'm assuming everybody has a point estimate, the same one of E dot over E. Yeah, I made it A. I used to use E, so I meant A for anticipated. Because this, to know how the exchange rate is going to change, I have to think ahead. Remember the derivative. Remember it's a limit. Like this. I've got to be able to think ahead a little bit. And I'm putting an anticipation on that. We'll come to expectations pretty soon, next week. How we might want to model those. Okay, so the superscript there is for anticipated. Other questions? All right, well, let me put the Mundell-Fleming model together then. We've got, it's basically has the pieces of the model I've been talking about, the ISLM model, plus these two new behavioral functions. So the Mundell-Fleming model has endogenous variables. It has Y, R, capital R. Capital R is the real exchange rate. R is the home nominal interest rate. Y is the home real GDP. And exogenous got the whole list that we're used to, plus international ones now as well. So it's got real transfers from government, taxes, government spending, stock of money at home, government bonds, private bonds, in other words, corporate bonds, inflation, anticipated home inflation rate, price deflator for the home GDP, for the foreign one, foreign real GDP, foreign interest rate, real net factor payments from abroad to the U.S., and then this anticipated, I guess I won't put subscripts on it, anticipated rate at which E is rising. Let me just call that theta. I'm going to treat it as a constant. Let me just write it as a single thing, theta. And the model is very similar to the one we've been working with, has the following elements. Question? Okay. It has behavioral function, same as before. Desired saving. Oops, now we've got to be a little careful. So we got to take Y, which is factor payments, add to it transfer payments plus from government, add to it net factor payments from abroad. So if we're thinking about saving of U.S. citizens, they have also these profits and wages from abroad, perhaps. There's accounting. I equals S plus T minus TR minus G plus CF now. Remember when we did the last, the derived accounting identity? Looked like that. There were three sources of financing, domestic invest, physical investment, private U.S. saving, government saving, net foreign financial investment. Going to be an assumption, as before, that people can control their saving so the desired and actual saving are the same. There's going to be a behavioral function, the desired physical investment depends on the real interest rate, in other words, the nominal rate minus the rate of inflation. That is the same as before. We've got, let me erase this big list of variables there. We've got behavioral function, this new one, number two over there, the desired net foreign financial investment depends on that. But I'm going to make the Mundell-Fleming assumption. This, just what I wrote down at the bottom of the other board. We just talked about that. I'm going to assume that people can control the amount of net foreign financial investment that they make so that the actual and desired always coincide. I'm going to have another behavioral function, that desired real holdings of domestic currency are this. And these have the usual assumption. So the partial derivative here of this argument is negative. Here it's positive. This one is positive and negative. This one is positive and negative, just as it was before. U.S. citizens don't hold foreign currencies here. They just hold domestic. Another behavioral assumption, number one, the new behavioral one. NX star, desired net exports, real terms. We talked about this last time. Those partial derivative signs. And finally, accounting. As we talked about the first day, there's a balance of payments. Accounting equation that looks like this. So if I take exports minus imports, plus factor payments in from abroad, plus foreign financial, net foreign financial investment, those things have got to sum to zero. So that was, again, something we talked about the first day. And the notion of equilibrium, we say we have an equilibrium. If the endogenous variables are such that we're getting the amount, the fiscal investment, actual, is equal to the amount people desired, that NX, net exports, in real terms, are equal to the amount people desired, and the amount of money people hold is equal to the amount they desire. So if those three things hold, we already have some other ones by assumption. But if the endogenous variables are such that these are all satisfied, I'm going to say we have an equilibrium.
Do you sort of assume that there are flexible exchange rates because you have nine balance of payments?
I'm assuming that this R adjusts, and PF are exogenous, so I'm assuming that the E implicitly adjusts to make that foreign exchange rate, or to make the foreign exchange market, in my picture from the first day, balanced, so that the inflow and outflow of dollars, inflow and outflow of pounds from that foreign exchange market balance. Yes? So there's the model. Nine elements, three endogenous variables, three conditions here for equilibrium. All right, let me talk about the equilibrium. That's going to have to hold is that R is going to have to adjust so that that's true. Otherwise, this and this are finite. If this is plus or minus infinity, this is never going to hold. So because the financial investments are perfect substitutes at home and abroad for equilibrium, we're going to need the interest rate at home to obey this. Notice that RF and the theta are exogenous. Second thing, part of the definition of equilibrium is that this be true. Once I've got number one, for this to hold, there's only one Y that's going to work, because I had the assumption that the partial derivative with respect to Y is non-zero, M and P are exogenous, expression number one fixes R from exogenous things. The only variable left, the only endogenous variable left in this equation is Y. It's going to have to be set by that equation. It's going to have to adjust to make that equation hold. Finally, these other two are going to pin down R now, capital R. From this thing, plus the definition of equilibrium, from the definition of equilibrium, I star has to equal I. From this thing, I has to equal S, but from number three, S has to be S star. And then that plus government saving plus CF. Now, from number 9, CF has got to equal negative NX, but in equilibrium, NX equals NX star. And then negative NFP. So I'm going to need this. In 1, I already see for equilibrium that R has got to be equal to RF plus theta. From 2, I can solve for what Y has got to be for equilibrium. So Y is set there. The only endogenous variable left in equation 3 is capital R. It'll have to adjust to make 3 hold. 3 holds from this, from the definition of equilibrium, from this, from 9, and again, using the definition of equilibrium. So 3 will determine capital R, the real exchange rate. So the model has got all these elements to it, but it's actually quite simple to solve. Yeah?
I think you're missing a star in element 4.
Yep. Good. Other questions? Let me draw the picture that's in the book. Before, we could characterize equilibrium with an IS and LM curve to find their intersection. The book suggests an analogous picture for this model. Again, we're talking about equilibrium here, characterizing equilibrium. Got 3 endogenous variables. It's hard to draw 3-dimensional pictures. Given the Mundell-Fleming assumption, for equilibrium, the interest rate at home is pinned down. So the book suggests using a picture to characterize the values of the other two variables, realizing that R has to equal RF plus theta. So this equation characterizes Y. They call that the LM curve. So it's the values of Y and R such that M over P equals K star of Y and little r, but little r is set exogenously now by conditions in the rest of the world and anticipations about the exchange rate. So you find the Y that makes this work. The equation doesn't depend on capital R. Therefore, once you find that Y, it works whatever capital R is. So the locus is just vertical. Now in this one, if we set R from here, R is fixed, so the left-hand side is fixed. The partial derivative of S star was going to be positive. The array of partial derivatives on NX star was going to be that. So if R, little r, is fixed, this is fixed. If we have a Y and a capital R that satisfies equation 3, then if we raise Y, this will go up, this will go down, but it's subtracted. So the chain, if Y goes up, it'll make the right-hand side go up. To counterbalance and keep equality here, I'll have to make R go up. So if Y goes up, R will have to go up. So he calls this the IS curve, and it's the locus YR such that three holds. So such that this works, where R is set at the what's internationally required here. That's an upward sloping curve. And then the equilibrium for the model, we got to have both two and three hold, is there. Whether you use the equations or the picture, you're talking about the same thing. We could use our total derivatives to find the slope of the IS curve. Let me not take time to do that. I'll just write it here. For a derivative in this picture, I want dr over dy. So I totally differentiate this, noting that little r is now constant because of equation 1. Collecting my terms, it's the partial of s with respect to its argument minus the partial of nx with respect to its y argument over the partial of nx with respect to its capital R argument. And by assumption, this is positive, this is negative, but it's got a negative here, so the top is positive, the bottom is positive, and slope is positive, just the way it worked out a minute ago. So there's the Mundell-Fleming model. It's a way to take that familiar Keynesian model and make it into an open economy model. It's implicitly assuming that the rest of the world is big relative to the home country, because it's treating RF and YF as being fixed. So if we do policy changes or something in the US, you might think they would affect England if the world was just the US and England. And you might think that RF would change and we'd have to take account of that. But if it's the US trading with all the rest of the world and England is just a stand-in for all the rest of the world, maybe you'd think the rest of the world is so big that if we change around our government policy or something, the world interest rate isn't going to change, so that RF being fixed exogenous is a legitimate assumption. So it's just implicitly assuming that the U.S. is a small country in the world. Small country assumption. All right. Well, let me quickly run through some comparative statics with this. Let's first do the case that we have open market operations. Let's expand the money supply at home by having the Federal Reserve take currency out of its vaults and buy U.S. bonds, takes U.S. government bonds. So it takes the bonds out of circulation, puts more dollars into circulation. What's going to happen? Well, let's think for a minute about a story. If we start in equilibrium, U.S. citizens are the ones that hold dollars. They have the amount they wanted in their portfolio relative to bonds. Now the government wants to induce them to take more, so it wants to buy some of their bonds. That will tend to bid up the price of bonds. If the bonds were originally sold with their face value, their expiration date, and their coupon printed on them, if they become more expensive, the implicit interest rate on those bonds has gone down. We talked about this before. In the ISLM model, when the interest rate goes down, it stimulates domestic physical investment spending, the little I. Here, it would do that, but far more important, it will change CF. It's more important because the CF, by assumption here, is perfectly interest elastic. You lower the U.S. interest rate a little bit. We were at equilibrium before. We were at the world interest rate. You lower it a little bit, all of financial investment turns around, goes the other way. And that overwhelms any effect you'd get out of physical investment. Well, if the financial investment is surging overseas, what is that doing? Flooding the foreign exchange markets with dollars. As citizens move their accounts overseas, they'll want to change them for pounds. And by the same token, it's going to create a scarcity in them of pounds. And to try and cope with this, the foreign exchange market's going to change the exchange rate. It's going to make dollars cheaper and pounds more expensive. Everybody wants pounds now. But when that happens, by assumption, that stimulates net exports. But Y is equal to C plus I plus G plus NX here. And if you can stimulate NX, you raise Y. And in fact, this thing is so interest sensitive that this story works with an infinitesimal, an invisible reduction in R. It's just an infinitesimal drop is enough to make this whole thing work. And the stimulus now comes not from physical investment, C plus I plus G with I changing, but from net exports changing. In terms of the picture, well, first, we have to realize that there's no change in the domestic interest rate. For equilibrium, we've got to have that. And RF and theta haven't changed. Other than that, from the picture, we started like this. What changes? The IS curve position doesn't change. There's no M in that. Nothing exogenous has changed that's in equation 3. The LM curve does change, though. For the same R, M went up. We need a bigger Y to have equality in 2. So the LM curve shifts. So the equilibrium shifts like that. What happens? Y gets bigger. I just tried to say verbally, R, the exchange rate, the dollar devalues, we have expansionary monetary policy, that happens, interest rate doesn't change. The reason why it can get bigger is because when the dollar devalues, it stimulates exports, net exports. We could do that algebraically. We have equation 1, so we can differentiate R with respect to M directly. R is just equal to a constant, so dr is just 0. So dr dm, open market, is 0. Equation 2 over there, we take total derivatives, the P isn't changing. The M is, so we take the partial derivative of M over P with respect to M, that's just 1 over P on the left-hand side. And then on the right-hand side, we take the partial derivative of K with respect to Y times dy. We could do the same partial of K with respect to R, dr, but we just saw that dr doesn't change here from equation 1. So we've got this. So we can collect terms here. We've got dy, dm. We can flag it. To recall what we're talking about here, it's 1 over p and then over ky star. This partial is positive by assumption. This is positive. There's a comparative static result. When we did the closed economy model last time, this thing was 1 over, this comparative static result was 1 over p, and then it had a ky, but then it had another term, kr times, so partial of k with respect to r, times partial of s with respect to y over partial of little I with respect to r. So it was positive, but everything else being the same, it was smaller, because it had the same numerator. In the denominator, it had the same first term, but then it had another positive term. So in this Mundell-Fleming model, monetary policy, everything else the same becomes more powerful. The magnitude of the comparative static derivative is bigger. And then we could differentiate 3. Let me just write it, what you get. You could figure that d capital R, dm, is, where is it? 1 over p over ky over the partial of k with respect to y times partial of s with respect to y minus partial of nx with respect to y over partial of nx with respect to r, capital R. And if you look at that, it's possible too. So you can do it algebraically or geometrically. Question?
I'm looking at the number 1, and it says R equals R plus theta.
Yep.
Now, I understand that that has to hold at equilibrium, and that we're dealing with infinitesimal changes, but how do you elicit the CF changes so greatly if there's no relative change between R and RF?
It's because that CF, because the foreign and domestic financial assets are perfect substitutes. If I changed R by any finite amount, non-infinitesimal amount, I'd have to get an infinite change in CF. And that could, if I was at equilibrium before, I could never be at equilibrium thereafter. But the thing is, it's perfectly elastic. So it had become a correspondence that CF could be anything as long as number 1 holds. So this is where the story sort of breaks down. I don't actually need to get any non-infinitesimal change in R. You could think of it as just going down infinitesimally. But it actually, CF is so elastic, it actually doesn't even need to change at all.
The model also assumes that domestic saving is not sensitive to domestic interest rates.
Yep. So that you mean private savings, saving by Americans, that S star thing depended only on current income flow in this model. So it's only on Y, which is interpreted as factor payments in that case, plus factor payments from abroad, plus transfers from government minus taxes. So So it's a very simple model of savings behavior. Only your current flow of resources and the interest rates are, your interest income is in that. It's in the Y. But only that determines how much you're saving. So on a more realistic model, you might think, if the interest rate is higher, I'll save more. But in this model, it's too simple for that. But we'll come to more elaborate dynamic models later, or things like that. Later.
So what's the motivation for why increase in the story of the life when actually there's no increase in the R?
Because to maintain equilibrium after I've increased M, the CF has got to go down. And that means there's less money coming in and from the balance of payments accounting identity, NX has got to get bigger to counterbalance that. The NFP is exogenous. So from the balance of payments accounting identity, CF plus NFP, which isn't changing, plus NX has got to be zero. If when M went up, this thing went down. To hold equality, this thing has got to go up, but that's a part of demand. Because yeah. Y is C plus I plus G plus NX.
But how can you have a finite decrease of CF?
CF is a correspondence. It's CF star. It'd be infinite if that was true, but it can be anything. People don't care where their money is as long as the interest rate of home and abroad are the same. So I can have a change within this interval following monetary policy, and the new equilibrium compels that. And once I've changed that, in the balance of payments accounting identity, NX has got to go up. And the way that that happens is the exchange rate changes to cause that to happen. So it'd be a little easier to, it would be easier to talk about if I didn't have the Mundell-Fleming strict perfect substitutes assumption. So if the CF thing was not perfectly flat, then we could get small changes here leading through here. The Mundell-Fleming assumption is it's perfect substitutes. That's what makes it a little hard to think about. But that's the idea. Are there other questions? All right, well, let's do fiscal policy. It's the second comparative static result. Let's increase domestic government spending. Finance it with government bonds. So again, we could think about a story. It's a little, as you can see, it's a little dangerous to think about these stories. Sometimes they help to establish intuition. If I increase government spending, Y is equal to C plus I plus G plus NX. So if G goes up, that will tend to make Y go up. If Y goes up, people are making more transactions, domestic transactions, so K star should go up. If K star goes up, people want more real money balances. The real money supply hasn't changed, so we all try to get money from each other. That means we're trying to sell bonds to each other. The price of bonds should drop. We're all trying to sell bonds to each other. That means if the price of bonds drops, the interest rate is going up. But if the domestic interest rate goes up, and the return abroad is exogenous, you get a tremendous inflow of foreign financial investments. When that happens, all these foreign financial investors are stopping in the currency market to get dollars. It's going to create a shortage of dollars there. The foreign exchange market will make the dollar more expensive. It'll give you fewer dollars per pound. As the dollar revalues, gains in value, it should hurt net exports. In fact, what happens is these two things end up counterbalancing, and why doesn't change? And the reason is it can't change. The CF is too elastic to tolerate any non-infinitesimal change in R. And so if Y was actually going up, there had to have been a change in R. So the drop in NX has got to be big enough to offset the G. In terms of the picture, you can see it. First, we can see that R doesn't change. But then from the picture itself, here we are originally. If you change government spending, bond finance, you haven't changed anything in the LM equation, anything exogenous. So the LM curve doesn't shift. You have changed G in equation 3, and in fact you can reason that the IS curve shifts out. But since the LM curve didn't shift, what you end up with is the dollar gaining in value, but no change in Y. So from the story, you can see that what's happening is the government increases its spending. It ends up just being counterbalanced by a drop in net exports in this model. So fiscal policy moves the real exchange rate, but it doesn't change Y anymore. So it loses its effectiveness for combating a recession. Monetary policy, on the other hand, works better than it did before. So if you believe this model, last time we thought we can spend our way out of a recession with more government spending or lower taxes, or we can rely on the Federal Reserve to increase the money supply to get us out. This time, all we have is to rely on the Federal Reserve, because changes in net exports will neutralize the effects of fiscal policy. You'll just build up the trade deficit if you have the government spend more money. All right, so it's kind of an interesting model. Are there any more questions? I'm going to leave it for now and come back to it a final time, either at the end of next week or, I think the end of next week for sure, when I do the Dornbusch paper. A couple more remarks before I leave it now. You can see that opening up the economy in this way makes a big difference for policy implications for this model. General, you might want to keep that in mind. We think of the economy as becoming more and more open. Here's one example of where it can make a big difference for government policy. If you're using a different model, you might want to be sensitive to that, worry about that. Another comment is we can see the need for dynamic analysis. example, we can see we need to model where this anticipation about exchange rate changes comes from. I mean, the model tells us how the exchange rate changes. If we had it seems like we should be able to deduce this E dot over E term in a more complete analysis. It makes a difference to these financial investors. They should be interested in predicting it. It seems like that should somehow be endogenous in the model. Another example, we should track the effect of CF, net foreign financial investment, on NFP over time. So if we have net foreign financial investment in the U.S., it means foreigners are buying up assets in this country. Over time, that surely will affect NFP, these net factor payments that are crossing borders. If foreigners are buying up a lot of assets here, it's going to make the NFP in the future go negative because profits will be leaving. So anyway, you can see a lot of instances where you would like to track the implications for what we're doing now over time and how they're affecting the same variables in the future. Okay. Any other questions? If not, let me leave this model, and I want to start talking about the static neoclassical model. Before I do that, I want to digress for a second and talk about aggregate production functions, which will be a piece of the static neoclassical model. So there's a handout in the course packet. Let me give you a little quicker story about aggregate production functions. Suppose I think of an economy where there's one output good, but there's many firms that produce it. Suppose that, now you talk about individual firms in 601. So let's think about an individual firm as having a conventional production function. So an individual firm's output, suppose it has production function Fi, it's firm I, index I, and suppose it uses capital and labor and produces output. So if it's firm I, it uses capital KIT and labor LIT, produces output. Let's suppose it has constant returns to scale. It's the simplest case. And the firm production function is conventional, so it's increasing each argument, concave in each argument. I want to assume it has constant returns to scale. Then, if we have a free market system, you also learn in 601 that if it's unimpeded, it should give Pareto efficiency. So if there's a, that's the first welfare theorem. So if there's a stock of capital, say KT, and a stock of labor, the LT, and the labor and the capital are going to be employed, free market system we'll see that they're allocated among the firms in such a way that we get an efficient outcome. In this simple context, that means that free market will succeed in maximizing the sum of outputs given the constraint on inputs. So if we got all these firms indexed I, we're only producing one output, then we can add up the outputs of all the firms, or it's all the same stuff. So a free market should maximize the sum of this thing, subject to the fact that we can't be using more capital than we've got. So let's let the aggregate be KT without an I. And subject to also that we're not using more labor than we've got in total. So let's let LT be the amount of aggregate employment. So if the free market wasn't allocating the capital and labor in such a way that sum was maximized, a dictator could come along and reallocate it and get more output. That would mean that we were Pareto inefficient before. And the first welfare theorem shows that doesn't happen. So if there are no distortions, externalities, taxes, we should be getting this maximized, subject to the constraints. Well, the aggregate production function is just the mapping takes the total amount of capital and labor into this total amount of output, which we call little yt. It's the total quantity of output. And I'm assuming that mapping encompasses this idea that the total stocks of capital and labor are being used efficiently. We've got a system that can use them efficiently. So given whatever aggregate employment there is, and whatever amount of capital is being used, we can go through this allocation problem, or we can let the market do it for us, and then we can look at the total output, which is what we call little yt, quantity of output, and the mapping between the k and the l and that little y is the aggregate production function. Well, let's assume that mapping gives us a function, that it's smooth, so we can even differentiate it. Let's go back and look at a firm's behavior for a second. The firms in the economy are trying to maximize profits. So the individual firms, so let's look at firm I. It cares about KIT and LIT. So price is PT for output. Here's its revenues. If it's competitive, it just takes the prices given. Takes the overall wage is given. Takes the rental fee on capital is given. That would be its profits. Try to maximize that. If it's doing that, it has first order conditions. It take the partial of this with respect to k, it ought to be 0. So we could divide each side of that by p. I could rewrite that then as this. There's one, it's picking the profit maximizing amount of labor. I don't, this doesn't equal 0. Oops, it does if I subtract it. So let's just write it that way. Let's write it equal. So when it was subtracted equals 0, I just rearranged it. Let's write it that way. So if the firms are doing that, that's the way we get the efficiency out of the complete economy. It turns out, if we take note of the fact that all the firms are doing that, we can find a characterization of the partial derivatives of the aggregate production function. So let's think about that. Let's go back to the aggregate production function. The aggregate production function is f without a subscript, without a superscript. It tells us for the overall amount of capital and overall amount of employment, how much overall output can we get. Suppose that I care about the partial derivative of that mapping with respect to k. So let's use our total derivatives. Total derivatives would say, if I have a mapping like that, induced by the allocation from the competitive market, there should be the total derivative. Y should also, I could write it as a summation of all the firm outputs. So when I take dy, I'm taking the total derivative of that. But I know how to take a derivative of a sum. I just take the derivative of each piece and add them together. The addition rule for derivatives. Differentiating f plus g, I take the derivative of f and add it to the derivative of g. So it'd be that. So that's kit there. Now I know how to take the derivative of each of these functions, the total derivative. We just use our rule. So partial of f with respect to its first argument times d of that plus partial of f with respect to its second argument times d of that. But now, think about the individual firm behavior. These firms are going about their business in the free enterprise economy, they should have set their partial derivatives equal to the real rental rate and the real wage. So every place I've got a partial of f with respect to k, no matter which I it is, I can put in the overall rental rate over p for that. And since that doesn't depend on I can take it out of the summation. So I can rewrite this as rent t over pt times summation dkit, and I can do the same thing with the second piece, wage t over pt times dlit. But overall, if the economy is allocating factors efficiently, it must be using all the available capital. It shouldn't be leaving any sitting around idle. If the partial derivatives of those Fs are positive. So overall, this must be true. So if I'm making it a change in Y, I could get that from a change in K or a change in L. But this must be true. The same must be true of L. It should, the constraint for that should hold with equality if I'm getting efficiency. So when I look down here, and here, first one here should be dkt, should be the, if I sum up all the changes in the capital for the individual firms, should be the change in the aggregate capital. So, the point I'm trying to make is, if we think of free market behavior as giving us this aggregate production function, then if I change Y by only changing K, holding L fixed, that would correspond to taking the first term here, setting DL equal to 0 so that that disappears. By all of this, that should correspond to, this one will be 0 if DL is 0. That should correspond to the rental fee. Plus 0. Here, I keep putting T's in here. Let me just drop them out all the way across. From this now, you can then see what the partial derivative of the, so rental fee on capital over P. If you have this aggregate production function, if it summarizes what's happening in the free market economy in a simple case, if I have this mapping, I know what its partial derivative is. What it's equal to. It's equal to the rental fee on capital in real terms. And I could do the same thing holding dk equal to 0, just changing dl. And get that. So what does that say? It tells me that those partial derivatives, the aggregate production function, are constant. They also give me the aggregate demand for capital and labor. Usually a demand function is a quantity as a function of prices. These are giving me prices as a function of the input quantities. They're in inverse demand function form. It gives me the inverse demand function in aggregate for capital, and the partial with respect to labor gives me the inverse aggregate demand function for labor in the economy. So if I think of an aggregate production function, I have amounts of capital, amounts of employment, I'm going to let the free market allocate them and look at total output, and I call that mapping F, the partial derivatives of it turn out to give me the factor prices. They turn out to therefore define the aggregate demand functions for capital and labor in inverse demand function form. I want to keep that in mind. It's not surprising when you think of it. If the total amount of capital and labor are being allocated efficiently, if I bring in one more unit of labor, if all the other units are used efficiently, it really doesn't matter where I allocate that last unit. It's called the envelope theorem. As long as all previous units are being used efficiently, if I bring in one little additional unit, I can allocate it to any firm. How much is it worth to a firm? Well, it's worth a wage. That's how much a unit of labor is worth. That's they were setting their marginal product equal to W over P. And that's what this is showing. Same thing for capital. All right, well, so much for getting to the static neoclassical model. I'll do that next time using this aggregate production function. And I'll also talk about the Lucas model. The Lucas paper is in your Xerox course packet. There's a little bit of reading on it in the textbook also. But I'd like to do both those things next time. Okay, if you didn't get a problem set for Thursday, I've got some extra copies. Remember, those will not be graded, but I hope you'll work on them ahead of time.